Welcome to a morning edition of the Work in Programming podcast. I'm here with my co-host this week, Tom Lamb.
Hi.
I'm your typical host, Matthew Weeks. So today we're going to talk about, you know, we've both worked in a variety of different companies. So we're going to kind of talk about, you know, the differences across, you know, the different types of jobs you can have as a software engineer. And like our experiences with them, and then how we recommend people kind of even like approach that, I guess.
Yeah, we're going to talk about one or two other things too, but I guess you'll probably remind me.
We'll get to them, I'm sure.
I'm still working on my first coffee.
I'm on tea today, and it's definitely hurting me. I normally need that jolt in the morning.
There's nothing worse than when you're like, you get up and you run out of grounds. This is like working from home problems. It's like, it used to just be like you just stop at a Starbucks on the way in, and now you're like, I guess I'm just working uncaffeinated until I get done my stand-up so I can sneak out and buy some more coffee grounds.
What type of coffee are you drinking lately?
Oh, okay, so this is another side effect of COVID.
Yeah.
Is that my coffee snobbery went down a couple notches because I live, we both actually used to like work downtown Toronto.
Yep.
And there was literally like 40 coffee shops that were like better than Starbucks within spitting distance. So Starbucks was like the base bare level of acceptability for coffee for me once I became a Torontonian.
Yeah.
I was never a Tim Hortons fan ever.
Oh.
But no, never. Blasphemy. Even though I was in Fredericton, which is like blue collar, you know, wonderful part of Canada. But definitely a lot more like Don Cherry Pro, like, you know, small town hockey, Tim Hortons, like that whole shtick.
Yeah.
I always hated Tim Hortons. I just thought their coffee tasted like shit. And they never had any like food options that had enough protein in them, in my opinion. It was always just
yeah.
bread. But anyway, so I always liked Starbucks, but then when I got to Toronto, I was like, I'm too cool for Starbucks now. Like, it was all this other stuff. And then of course, working from home now, the whole point of this long speech is that I've gone back to Siren's beans from Starbucks is
my favorite coffee.
Cause I'm out on Bloor West, and for some reason the coffee snobbery doesn't come this far west. So there's all these like shitty, like second cups and Tim Hortons, cause I'm in suburbia now and I don't go downtown very often.
My go-to is always like prior to living in Toronto, I hated Starbucks. I thought it was a place to work if I was like desperate, but if I could find a second cup, I would go to a second cup.
Really?
I was very adamant about that. I don't know why, but I was like, that was my personality. For a while
I thought Starbucks was like to get a table at a Starbucks when I was in Fredericton was like anyway
yeah fair enough. I mean, like, I think I just had that vision of it, so I just thought it was a little too bougie. So now that I'm in Toronto, like I said, like I was gonna say, I just buy whatever the Starbucks round of the week is. So I'm like, yeah, 100% spending. Yeah. I spend more at Starbucks than I think any other store at this point. Like except for Metro, you know, like I go to Starbucks, I budget myself every month, and I give myself like $120 budget for coffee because I know I'm gonna go over otherwise. And like everything else is like minimal.
Yeah, like since I quit drinking, basically it's like groceries, going out for dinner. Fuck, we can't even do that right now. So it's like skip the dishes, Uber Eats, Starbucks. It's funny how much money we're saving now.
Oh, dude. I paid off like all of my debt because of because of COVID.
COVID.
Yeah.
It's the COVID student fucking loan program. Yeah. God damn it. Anyway, this just got... Yeah, so I don't know. Maybe we'll edit that out. But
no, I think we'll keep it. It's a good intro.
Yeah, if people can't make jokes about the situation, then they're fucked.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously, like, this comes up, like, often. but I mean, it has to come up in every conversation, right? It's like, we have a certain level of like, we're definitely lucky that we're not affected by some of the effects of all of this. And then, you know, there's always going to be multiple different facets to it, right? Like it's like, there's positives in some ways. Like it's not like we're bad people for having.
No, I remember like in March, I was on the phone arguing with, or no, I guess it was July. Yeah, it was July. I was on the phone arguing with someone because I had booked an Airbnb because I was like trying to go from one condo to another townhouse. And I needed like somewhere to stay for 2 months in between during COVID. And I booked an Airbnb and it turned out to be a dump. And I was like trying to deal with these people. And they were kind of like, you know, I don't know what you're complaining about because like people are dying right now and you don't have a right to. And I'm like, I don't have a right to what, like good customer service from somebody I just gave like a couple $1,000 to. I'm like, it's just that everybody was kind of like grabbing onto COVID and throwing it, pointing at people and saying like, see, this is going on right now. So heck man, try calling Service Canada right now. Like it just, they just don't answer anymore.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
You know what I found is like the government services actually like really pulled through. Cause like when I was trying to get like a doctor and like the support number for that, like I'd called it before and they were like, it's going to be like a 4 hour wait. And I called during COVID and it was like, you know, 45 minutes maybe.
Yeah. I agree with you. Like there's definitely been some organizations that have really stepped up and like really done, like busted their butts to help Canadians and stuff. It's awesome.
But there's a lot of like, yeah, like individual level, like businesses that like, it's, I think like the Airbnb thing, I'm sure the guy was just being lazy, but like, you know, if I had an Airbnb, I would be like sketched out to go and clean it. But then at the same time, cause you know, like if someone
was there
and they had it, like the best thing is like people are using Airbnbs for their quarantines, right? So
yeah. As long as you're cleaning it safely. Yeah, I know it's an interesting and a pretty emotional subject, but
yeah.
But I mean, I think just in general, like, I mean, we weren't planning on talking about COVID, but I mean, I the one thing I think is just that anytime you introduce pressure into an environment, you cause people to act more like their true selves. So whether they're good people or bad people, the more pressure they're under, the more likely they are to drop whatever facade they're creating and start acting like themselves. So you see some companies are being really nice and they're being really supportive, and some companies are being really mean. And it's just kind of like, as you add more pressure to the environment, you polarize things. Things get a little bit more, which I don't mean polarized like politically, I mean polarized like just like, if you're a good person, you're gonna stop with all of this subterfuge and you're just gonna start just being who you are because you don't have time for this shit because you're stressed out. And of course, the more that people get stressed out too, the more they drop back to their base instincts and they stop caring totally. And I get that, but you definitely do see like some companies and some services, even in the government, there's some parts of the government that are doing a really good job. There's some companies that are doing a really good job taking care of their employees.
Yeah.
There's other companies that are doing a really bad job, which we can get into later.
Totally, yeah.
I'm not thinking of any companies specifically.
I think it exposes like the, it's, I think they're like, Nassim Taleb talks about like that anti-fragility versus fragility. And you don't know if a system is fragile until it's put under stress, like under duress. Yeah. It's like, you know, the supply chain seemed fantastic, you know, super efficient, highly effective. Everyone thinks it's going to keep working. And then you, lo and behold, it's collapsed because China was the linchpin. And like the rest of the world is like just over-optimized for like the worst things, right? So like now we're realizing that there's, and we're improving, like some countries are doing better, some countries are doing worse. And I think that would be the same with businesses. Cause like for me, I think like some businesses just aren't as organized as they like to put up or portray, and their financial success isn't as good, or their margins aren't as good, or their processes suck, right?
I almost feel too like, I mean, it's kind of shitty timing, but something, so I almost like, I think about one company that I interviewed for a while ago and I didn't get the job. I guess maybe it was like, I guess it was like 2 years ago. Man, it's funny how fast time goes. But there was definitely a period where every startup was just like, it's going to be a unicorn. Everything is awesome, you know, and the cash was just flowing. And so like nobody was really being held to task on their unit economics, or like a lot of companies that in by themselves without the support of the startup ecosystem would not have survived, would not have been, you know, like if it wasn't for, you know, the early 2000 companies like Facebook, Google, all these companies that actually created this optimism around tech. Mm. Like those are the companies that literally came out of nowhere and just blew it up. And then everybody was like, okay, you know what? Tech is awesome. If you're a .com, here's some cash. And then now we've gotten to the point where it's like, you know, it's like, oh, well, it's Uber for dog walking. And you're like, oh, Jesus Christ. Okay. And like, yeah, we just raised $10 million. Like, okay, sure.
I think Uber for dog walking makes a lot of sense if you're not in the middle of a code, like a pandemic.
Sure. But my point was, it's just that, so then you've got these recruiters that are on LinkedIn and they're like, yeah, we're hiring for this company. We're hiring for this company. And then COVID hits. And also there was kind of a little bit of a correction of like, hey, like a lot of these companies are not, don't make any sense at all. Mm-hmm. And so I think I'm almost a little bit glad that like there's a little bit of a correction where it's getting to the point now where if a company isn't actually viable, it's probably not going to be hiring developers like in the next year.
Right.
Because the problem with companies that are not, that don't make sense hiring developers is that developers then have to go work for people that are crazy and that don't know what the fuck they're doing. And then they get this idea of like, why, like, so do you understand what I mean? It's like,
yeah, kind of.
It's like, yeah, sure. It's great that you got a brand new Mac and you got a gig, but the guy you're working for isn't actually that great of a boss. You're probably learning a bunch of bad habits because all of the startups are getting blank checks. And so nobody's really like, as long as they're able to do their slide deck and get a few, you know, a little bit of growth, that's kind of a problem.
I think my interpretation of that in Toronto, or especially like in Canada, is basically like, if you went to Waterloo or U of T, then you're,
or you worked for Amazon for 2 years,
Amazon or Facebook or Google, you walk into the city and you used to just get a blank check for exactly. Like any inane idea that you had.
Yes.
It didn't matter if you were actually like that great,
good at your job,
or it just mattered that you had some like arbitrary name or whatever on your Reddit. But like, I think that there's also
like we had a bunch of false flags for good ideas. Like we had a bunch of false signals that were incorrect, like, oh, you worked at Google, therefore your idea is probably good.
Well, I mean, I think those businesses might still just succeed for the sake of it, but that's another point. Like that's completely outside of it, but I think like yeah, like a lot of businesses are being exposed for like, there's, and I think like there's a lot of, and this could get into our main topic, which is like, I think there's like a lot of different there's a different pieces of a company that can cause it to like either succeed or fail. And like, it's not necessarily like, okay, the product might make sense. It might not. Right. There's other aspects to it. Right. Like, so
how do you hire?
Yeah. And like, not everything's a startup. Like, you know, for instance, we both come from a big, background in, like client services and, consulting. And so those business models make a lot of sense when businesses are hiring out work. And when they're doing R&D and stuff like that. And that also depends on
what kind of economy you're in.
What kind of economy? Yeah. And there's actually some businesses that might be doubling down on hiring contractors, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
But agencies, because they have overhead, are, I think, suffering and losing some contracts, especially when you consider like the economics, like the way that they price it, they're effectively charging out, I think, double in most cases.
At least.
And that margin is there, it doesn't only cover costs, but it's not that much profit. Like I think it's higher profit margins than like selling t-shirts online, right? Like the profit margins are probably up there, you know, maybe like 20 to 30%, yeah. I guess. But like, I would doubt that it would actually get anywhere above that. And it's probably below that. And the thing is that the businesses that are hiring out these developers, in some cases, would rather just hire internally now because it's theoretically lower risk. It's like, I think different businesses are shifting in different ways.
It's really confusing too, because like you see a lot of, like I just figured out how to change my LinkedIn so the recruiters would stop. This is going to sound really pretentious, but guys, like anybody listening, like anybody that has, basically anybody that has a job right now, recruiters are going to be bothering you. But every time they'd ask me, I'd be like, well, if it's contract, like, you know, let me know, you know, because I'm open to taking on contracts. I'm not right now, but I'm interested in that now because I work as a freelancer now. But, and they're always like, no, we want to do a hire. And I'm like, and I don't know if that's because the recruiters want to do a hire because that's how they get compensated, or I don't know if that's what companies want.
I think it depends on the company, because I've noticed that for sure the bigger companies out there like aren't looking for contractors right now. It feels like I think they want to like pare down. A lot of bigger companies are like trying to like pare down on like hiring internally, because I think when it depends on your size too, right? Like if you're like a 500 plus person company, you've got your established processes. Yeah. So like you only hire contractors when there's like some extra work you need. Right.
Right.
So like what you really want most of the time is to be able to train somebody on your product. That's what I've noticed as like working in a product company is you're really like, I'm used to like, so you work at a consulting agency, you start day one and the way that you deliver value is by working for a client. So
yeah,
they want you like to get to the client office as quickly as possible. Sometimes they'll promise you a week and sometimes it's less than that. Like I remember when I started up my, like when I started the company that we both worked at, I started day one, I started setting up my computer. A friend of mine, mentor Alvaro Pino gave me his like little dot files repo. So I had quick onboarding, like technically I'm like, oh, just like .install and boom, we've got like all of this, all of the dev stuff that I need. I'm right. Good. And then they're like, oh great, you're onboarded? Cool. All right, we need you to go to the client office tomorrow to like introduce yourself to the client. I didn't know my role on the client team. I didn't know pretty much anything, right?
Yeah. And then, yeah, so actually, why don't we formally get into the differences. Like, I think you should keep telling the story because it's super informative.
Okay, yeah.
But we're going to start talking about the difference between working for an agency, working for a product company, we started 5 minutes ago, or working freelance. And maybe there's other things to do. Okay, so day one, hey, you actually are onboarded. Okay, can you go to the client immediately?
Yeah. So that kicks off. And so what I noticed is, so like, I like to treat client work as closely as like being a part of the team as I can. Like, I feel like there's a reputation in the industry in some cases where people expect like consultants to not really care about the code that they write, for instance, or they're trying to do the new fancy thing sometimes. And I think you're often brought in to do that sort of stuff, but the best consultants or the best contractors or whatever always focus on being a part of the team as closely as they can, but they're like an outsider joining the team. So like what we ended up doing was we met with the client team, we talked about their architecture, we met some of the developers, and we kind of got an idea of like what the project roadmap was or what the structure was.
So let me interrupt you there. Yeah. So like just trying to understand where these different kinds of companies fit in. So if what you're saying is that if you're a medium to large size product company, the reason you're going to hire either an agency or contractors is maybe you've got a sprint coming up and you want extra dev resources. You don't have the time to hire. It's not for a full-time engagement. Mm-hmm. It's something like 3 to 6 months. We really want to get this out the door. It's like there's something new that we want to do. I think what I saw from all of the medium to large size companies engagements that we did through an agency were, we've got this new thing we want to do. We don't want to take on a bunch of full-time equivalency. We don't want to hire a bunch of people. We just want to bring in a team, give them this whole thing to deal with and get it done, get it out the door. Is that fair to say?
So that's actually, maybe we can talk about the different types of engagements that you can have as an agency. So like typically I'd say there's three major types, right? So you've got like a client project that you completely own,
yeah,
right? And so that is like, I think the first project that you worked on was a lot about that, where you take over, either you're doing it net new, which is actually the two types that I was going to talk about, is like, you've got greenfield and brownfield, even though they're mixed, but you know, brownfield, you're taking over an existing project and maybe either somebody worked on it before and they screwed it up or they had to leave, or like they just didn't get done.
So greenfield means a brand new application, and brownfield means you've got an application in place and you're replacing parts of it as you go. Keep going.
And then so the other side of that is staff augmentation. So staff augmentation is like more so what I was doing, where, you know, it's a large company. They want to hire out a team, but I don't think they trust themselves or want to be in the business of hiring individual consultants unless they know them really well, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So there's like, if you don't have the relationship and you with a business already, and you don't have a network already, and you want to find work with a large company to get your foot in the door, agency is definitely the way to do it when you're doing the staff aug type stuff. But when you're doing staff aug, you're basically working on the client's team.
Yeah.
But they're just basically trying to bolster their numbers because they, like you said, like they've got a project that they just can't handle, something's behind, or, you know, they want to do something else.
I feel kind of obliged to drop in a little plug for A-Team here, mm-hmm, because, and I'm not sure if I'm allowed, I don't think they're going to care. So just a little, but you know what, we'll come back to it. But it's that idea of like an agency is the way to solve that problem. But there are inherently problems with an agency, like you just talked about, like the margin, the gross margin and the net margin, the expenses that an agency has that get carried over into the client costs, like shit like that. Like there are some players in the space now that are trying to disrupt the agency model, like A-Team, because they're more nimble. They can solve that same problem with a lot less overhead and deliver a better value, I would say. But
and they also improve on, so like, I guess, yeah, so we could get into like the major, like, so like we're talking about agency, which is like a traditional agency is like a business in the business of hiring either full-time employees at the agency or consultants. Like they could hire contractors, which I did for a little bit. We can also talk about that.
Well, maybe keep it just agency, product, freelance, because otherwise it'll turn into a 4-hour episode.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So like we've so, and then there's contracting, which is, it's basically just you're working for any of these businesses. So like maybe let's ignore the contracting stuff, but like, so you've got your agency.
Agency is just contracting is just a really small agency, really.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, in some ways it is, in some ways it isn't. Cause like if you're working for an agency, if you're working full time for an agency, let's assume you have a full time job, but the only thing is that your deliverable is like services delivered to a client, right? Versus a product company, your deliverable is the product, right? So there's some changes in like your focus, but if you're working as a contractor, you're contracting directly with that company in most cases, like I would say like what you're doing right now. In a way, and actually that's more freelance, but so I guess contracting is just a different like hiring mechanism. Like anyone can contract for any business. Like if you get hired for a contract, and this is something that like Brian taught me, is like, if you go somewhere and you say like, look, like I'd love to work for you guys, but I don't think the salary's in my range. Like I want to do contract. Almost all companies will just sign off on a contract basis and then pay you whatever hourly rate, as long as it's free. And so like, that's a way of, you're taking on additional risk because, you know, they don't have work, they can just say, don't work.
The other thing about that, I feel like that whole idea of like, you're taking on additional risk is kind of like, honestly, guys, like the fact that you have a full-time job does not give you any security whatsoever. Like
it doesn't in the,
it's
in
psychological, in general,
but I would say, to be very clear, like I was working contracted. This is why I wanted to bring it up, is immediately after working full-time with, like when we were working full-time at the previous agency, I went into contract work and I contracted with another agency. And what ended up happening was, you know, at first it was great because I was working full-time hours. I got a higher hourly rate. So I had increased my earning potential significantly. And yeah. I loved it because like I had more flexibility. But the key is that like I'm working for this company. This company, if they don't have work, like it's not like I don't still get paid if they don't have work. So I ended up in a situation where I actually was supposed to be contracted out to another client. And so they terminated their contract with the previous client, but they didn't actually get the next contract signed yet. And so I wound up on a like 3 month or 3 week sabbatical with like no work whatsoever. Yeah, unscheduled, unexpected. In fact, it was supposed to be a week and it turned into three, right? So like, I think there's a huge risk with contracting, which is why I actually think like contracting should only be considered like it's a tool for like increasing leverage at a job, but I wouldn't treat it as like your own business necessarily, because you're still like super susceptible to that client.
So, and then do you think freelancing, see, like, that's why I prefer freelancing.
Exactly. And freelancing, the thing is that contracting, you can make a certain amount, but freelancing, it's a bump above that. Like, I would say, like, if you're doing full-time to contracting, there's like a 20% gain. And then if you're going contracting to freelancing, there's a 20 to 40% gain, depending on how you leverage it.
Yeah. Like, I'm currently like, I think probably making about twice what I was as a full-time senior software engineer. Mm-hmm. And I'm fine. And I need to, basically for me on the freelancing side, yeah, like I am budgeting for like, okay, well, you know, it'll be nice if I've got like a 2 month buffer there just in case.
Yeah.
Because that's going to happen. It's a lot easier to deal with like a month downtime if you've got money in the bank and it's a vacation. If you don't have money in the bank, then it's anxiety. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
And I mean, like, I think in general, if you're going to go any route, actually, you should have like a month's income just saved up, because, you know, you never know when a pandemic's going to hit or something bad's going to happen. Yeah. I would say like having that buffer is in general useful, but I think, yeah, like if you're freelancing, it should increase, because like what I noticed was, okay, so I increased my hourly rate significantly when I started freelancing, but I actually didn't pay myself more. I just kept it in the business. And so now, after I've already left the client, I could theoretically continue paying myself for at least a month or two. And that's my business's runway. And I think that's like, when I first freelanced, when I like was like, you know, when I first started out with development, I worked for a year and a half and then I started freelancing.
Yeah.
And I think I took on all the risk without, well, actually, I mean, I was able to make $50 an hour as like a pretty junior intermediate type developer. Right. I would say, I guess. So like, that's great. You know, you can make more money doing that. And so that was, and it gave me access to like all these different little clients and like different projects and lots of different technologies, all that. But it's huge risk. Like, I was without clients for like 3 months at a time, and I didn't treat it like a business. I treated it like a job. And so I think that's the biggest difference for me is like, if you have a business, you have to treat it like a business. And I think contracting is in that like middle ground where you could treat it like a job, but you should treat it like a business if you can.
Yeah. Okay. So because we're talking about a lot of different things at once, which is great. Okay. So we talked about agencies and product companies a bit. I didn't really weigh in too much on that yet, but I will. And then we talked about freelancing. And the point you're bringing up right now is incredibly important. I want to double down on that too. And I'm not doing that right now because I've only been freelancing for a month. Mm-hmm. But the plan is exactly what Matt said, is create a company, incorporate, and then create a budget and live well below your means. There's no reason why I can't live off of the same basically paycheck that I was getting a couple months ago or a month ago, I guess, when I'm making twice as much or whatever. But there's definitely got to be a line item on the budget for, like, you know, operational expenses or several line items for a couple reasons. One, because if you're not paying your company and then paying yourself, I'm not an accountant, but obviously corporate income tax is much lower than personal income tax. Mm-hmm. There's a number of things you can write off. There's a number of things you can give yourself as an employee. There's all sorts of things you can do to minimize your tax liability. It's also just good sense, like Matt just said. Like, it's the way I look at it is that I never want to have to work for anybody again. I don't like working for people, full stop. And I think Matt would say, he might actually say, like, actually, I do like working for people. We're different. We're different kinds of people. Maybe not. I can't speak.
I mean, I could talk about that. Yeah. So like the reason that I, so what I've noticed, and I think this is a good point about why to get into certain things.
Yeah. That's what I was trying to do, but yeah. Yeah.
So my kind of like, cause like, well, just like from my perspective, it's like, I was in an agency for, like three years. And then that gave me a good chance to like learn really quickly. And then I wanted to get into a product company, but I wound up finding myself freelancing just cause like I tend towards that kind of like, I don't know, like that's just an easy to like find kind of, it's a good, cool idea. Like I really want to be able to have a business of some sort.
Yeah.
But I think for me, it was like, there's an opportunity to either work closely with a product that I really, really love, or to, you know, continue building, like just working on a freelance client, which is still like, it's engaging work. But I think what I mean is the business I want to build long-term isn't necessarily a services business.
Yeah.
It's going to be a sort of like a form of like a training / content business. And then I will also have my full-time role where that's like where I spend the majority of my time, but I get to work with like, you know, an excellent team that is working on a product that I really love. And then you also have the ability to build that team, which is a different.
Yeah. So like another thing you're not saying, like you're not explicitly stating, but I think is implied with what you're saying is that you wanted to go to a product company because then you could see a long-term complex project. Mm-hmm. Product, and you could learn things that you might not get from building another 6 month long e-commerce web app.
Exactly.
Like, so you're around principal engineers, you're around, so you got this long in the fucking tooth software application with probably like many alt applications. And now you're starting to see complex problems that happen when you have something, that kind of thing. And then, so you, it's going to level you up as a developer. Because you're literally working day to day with like guys that have more experience and more knowledge.
Exactly. And like, I'm not saying that isn't available in the agency world. Like I actually found that's why I got into the agency world is like, there's a lot
really?
Of, you could, well, when I first started at like Tribal Scale, like the business is very based around like teaching. And there are a lot of people who are pretty junior, or like years wise, they haven't been working for super long.
Yeah.
But what I've noticed is that there's a certain level of best practice type stuff that you can get, not always get, but can get when you work across a bunch of different projects. Cause you see,
I gotta be honest. I, that was not my experience. My experience was that I was constantly saying, I must be misunderstanding this. We can't possibly be doing it like this. This is not correct. Do you know the story about the emperor with the new clothes?
Yeah, the emperor.
You're like, just like, is anyone else gonna fucking point this out? Or, and I was just constantly like, okay, I guess I actually just kind of felt all the time like, I'm just gonna shut up because I don't want to point out that this is not correct. And we'll just put a pin in that because that could be one very small experience. But I've also heard from some people in some agencies that they're actually feeling like they're detraining because they're being constantly asked to build the same, like they're constantly being asked to recycle code from other projects. Mm-hmm. Just saying, just random observations.
Which at some level, that's what an agency's IP ends up being, is their reusability. If they do it well.
If they do it well. And
so processes.
Let it be postulated that Tom Lamb saith, I do not know of, I have not personally observed an agency where they're actually like using best practices in 2020, not 2012. The problem with this whole like, oh, we're recycling code is like, well then when are you updating it? Because apparently you're shipping developers off to this client site within 12 hours. Mm-hmm. There's literally no line item in your budget for process optimization or improving or removing tech debt. So if you're regurgitating code, then I guess you're still just like using what, Ruby on Rails and shit, or like you're rolling your own databases and you're.
So, okay. That's
you know what I mean?
No, like I get what you mean. I think that like I don't know. Like I think that there's you can do it well. You know what is funny though is I always said that and I always thought that, and now I'm at a like an actual like.
Well, there's two possibilities.
Meeting provider in like a product company.
Yeah.
And they do this shit. Like they actually have this stuff. And so I get what you mean. Like I think that there's like if you're domain specific in your agency, you could do this. And that's like the goal. That's the dream. That's what everyone wants.
Except nobody's fucking domain specific. I mean, you might say no to a WordPress project, but you're not going to turn down a fucking $5 million contract because it's not in MarTech. You know, like, give me a break. You're not going to do that. I think there's a lot of bullshit in the whole agency scene. I don't think it's I don't think it's the fault of any one agency. I think it's just part of that game. I mean, at the end of the day, like it's also just a question of like being transparent. It's one of these problems where they don't want to admit what they're actually trying to do. Mm-hmm. And so they're constantly trying to like position themselves as a startup. You know, they're like, oh yeah, we got a foosball table. Oh, we got fucking, you know, unlimited vacation. Like,
well, I think like the extreme side of that is where I worked for an agency where I had stock options and they were like, oh, do you want to execute your stock options? And I'm like, are you guys going to exit? Like, what are you going to do? Sell your agency? What?
Yeah, like,
I'm not going to buy stock options, but like, I think the foosball tables are fine.
I have no problem with the foosball table. I no problem. I guess it's, I like foosball actually, but I just mean like the whole cachet of a startup, the whole idea of trying to like get people to come work for you because it's, yeah, I don't really know what I was trying to say there. I think it's just that, you know, I think people like whatever your role is, like I think agencies are a very valuable thing and they need to continue to exist. And they do bring, probably they bring junior or even intermediate level developers a lot of good experience. Mm. One in just like actually working on real projects. Mm-hmm. I would say that anybody with more than a couple years experience though, and depending on the size of the agency, the size of the projects, it might be time for you to go look at like working for a product facing company, you know, maybe I don't know what you
Well,
think.
Let's maybe like contrast that because I think you get different experience out of being a contractor or sorry, being at a product company versus being at a services company.
Absolutely.
So like we could talk about different venues because you built your own product before. So that's like it's entirely own thing. But I think there is like it's like related in that like that it's same attempt. Yeah.
My story actually, and I'll keep it real short, but my story actually might be an interesting comment on because I built my own product and I learned. So and let's just like talk about two different kinds of learning. There's your like business / entrepreneurial learning. And then there's your technical learning.
I think there's also like communication, like there's so much out there.
Amen.
And I think that's where an agency really excels is being able to communicate complex ideas to people who don't understand it.
Amen. Amen. Yes. Yes. Cause the thing was, is that I was feeling a little shitty about like how I just shit, like I just talk shit about agencies and I'm like, well, they do actually have a very important job.
I think what you were saying is like they have to portray a certain image in order to get those clients or whatever.
Right? I wish they wouldn't. I wish they wouldn't do this whole, you know, oh, we're cloud engineers. And it's like, Jesus Christ, guys. Like, are you seriously telling me if Loblaws calls you up and says, we need you to rebrand our website and it's a $20 million job, you're not just going to be like, yeah, we're down. Like, we're doing CSS and HTML for the next 6 months. Like, come on, you know, like this whole idea of like, I guess one thing, okay. So I guess one of my like pet peeves is anytime that I hear a software engineer going on and on about how hard it is to be a software engineer and how complicated it is. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, really? Like, I'm sorry, but I think it, and like, because I just feel like that makes people feel like it's a career path that's not open for everybody. And I think that there's a lot of people that could be maybe not great software engineers, but definitely software developers. And they could have a lot of impact. And there's a huge deficit. There's
so like an example is like, I literally just did an episode earlier this week with my friend Ivan, and he left school as like a chemical engineer, like just didn't like doing the educational type stuff, left university, moved to Alberta, became a plumber for several years, and then just decided one day, I mean, I'm sure he made a good money as a plumber, and then just decided, you know, I'm going to teach myself how to do something new. So he left his job, and then at some point stumbled into code.
Yeah.
And then started doing all these tutorials and, you know, YouTube, Medium, whatever.
Yeah,
and then
yeah, yeah.
a year later, applied for his first job. You know, he'd already built all this stuff, which I think is key for anyone getting started, is just build shit, like build actual shit. And then he got his first job, and like, he's been working for 3 years now, and he's great. Like, he's an amazing engineer from what I can tell.
Absolutely. Like, absolutely.
And so I think that's,
I just remember, and it wouldn't be a podcast with Tom if I didn't mention the Army at least once, and then weightlifting later on. But I just remember like this one time when I was in training I was a military engineer for a while. And we spent like 3 years civil engineering at Royal Military College Canada, and Troop Duty Valor. So we're these like 21-year-old, you know it all. We're a bunch of assholes, right? And we're learning how to like land a raft on a bridge, on a beach. So we're like scooping soil out of the ground, and we're like putting a densiometer on top of it to see how quickly it'll compress, to see if the tank, when it comes off the raft, will get stuck on the beach, or if it'll be able to like drive up. Hmm. And so this old grizzled like master warrant officer comes out, and he's like, starts yelling at us, like, you know, what are you idiots doing? And we're like, oh, we're calculating the I don't even know, the tensillary strength of the soil or some shit. And he just takes his size 12 boot and he just like kicks it into the ground, and he's like, yeah, tanks will be good, you're done. And he's just like, you got a bunch of civil engineering students here, I bet you between the whole bunch of you couldn't even build a fucking picnic table, could you? And we're just like, probably not, you know. And I think of that a lot too when I'm like, when I see software and development, because like, this just totally went into another area and we should probably come back. Yeah. But it's that idea of mechanical engineer is not the guy that's going to be able to know how to like fix your car. Hmm. There's it's well understood in other engineering disciplines that tradesmen are incredibly important and valuable. And there's no, like, sure, maybe an engineer gets paid slightly more or maybe a little bit more after several years of training, but like, trades are respected, they're valued. Being a good tradesman is important. And a lot of software development is not engineering, it's trades. It's like, how do I do this? And just like a tradesman needs to understand like hydrodynamics, they need to understand those things too. They just don't need to have a master's degree in them.
Yeah.
You know, and like you need to understand how a browser works, but you don't need to have read all four of the art of computer programming, like of data algorithms and that. You don't need all that. Anyway.
I think that's like, I mean, even like getting into that, it's just like, I think that is a narrative that people push because like they're trying to gatekeep in the industry. Like, I mean,
yeah,
like it is a trade in my opinion. Like the way that we learn how to do things, it's just not as organized as a traditional trade. You don't have a blue seal or whatever. But like, if you ask an engineer like how they got started, it's normally like A, they had a mentor, and B, they started doing the job, right?
Yeah.
You do your first few jobs, you don't get paid that well because you're not experienced, but then you learn a lot, you get really good. And I think that's, to me, like that's the value of an agency.
You just took the words out of my mouth. Yeah. And that's exactly what an agency can do for you. They can give you that confidence.
And that's where I was getting at, is like, if you work on multiple different projects, you're going to learn a lot faster in terms of like, you know, what works and doesn't work in different scenarios, at least at the beginning. Right. And you're going to see how different people have done it, and you're going to get either snobbish about it, or you're going to learn from it depending on what it is. But I think at a product company, if I was a junior engineer at a product company, I feel like I would actually, I don't know for sure.
I don't know.
Been there, but
do you really think there's roles for junior? I mean, juniors being like less than 2 years of experience. Do you think there's room for junior engineers in product company?
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. Like that's the,
like, I'm not talking like a Waterloo grad with a, like an IQ of 180. I'm talking.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's how you could, I mean, like, I think in a product company, you'd want to have a balance, like in any company. I think like we could talk about, like, I think the perfect team structure is like five people. You can start like, or sorry, like two front end, two back ends. So like basically four engineers with at least one of them or two of them being like intermediate to junior and maybe one or two seniors. And like, ideally you should be mentoring, because like the thing is that to me, a senior engineer, their value is less in like getting things done at the minutia. And it's more like teaching people and like learning those, like they know this know-how, and they're like, if you were to consider like a journeyman at a trade, they're the ones they're running the company, but they're they're like helping with the team. They're still doing the work, but they're teaching somebody else through osmosis. And so like, you definitely train up amazing, amazing engineers like that. I think my point was, is that if I started off as a junior engineer, actually I started off doing a product company. I think it's a good way to, I think it's like probably the easiest way to get in. Like, it's however you can get your first job is the best first job you can have.
Amen. Amen. Yeah.
But for a product, I was saying is if I worked at one product company for 4 years, I'd learn that product really well. And I'm that's where I want to be now. But when I first started out, I wanted to learn about a bunch of different stuff.
And I think like, I get what you're saying. I think that they are both things most people would probably want to do in their careers. Mm. It doesn't matter the order that you do them in. If you go to the product direction, you're probably going to get more on the technical side. You're going to get more comm skills inside of your team. Obviously, you go to the agency side, you're going to get more breadth of knowledge. Mm-hmm. Cause like, if you go on a product side, you might never even touch like a lot of JavaScript because your tech stack is this. And so you're going to work at this.
Or you might find that like at a big enough company, the tech stack almost doesn't matter. And they were working in Ruby, but Ruby wasn't that great long-term. So they started migrating to.
Yeah. And they got a microservices, blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
And the thing is that
I feel like, you know, an artifact is something that continues to exist, even though it still has no value. At least that's my personal definition of an artifact.
Yeah.
So if you drive by on the highway, if you drive by a sign that says 2 + 2 = 5, that doesn't mean that 2 + 2 = 5. That means that at some point somebody thought that and they put it into the universe and it persists, even though it's incorrect. Mm-hmm. So the idea of gatekeeping and trying to prevent and try to make people feel like you've got some proprietary knowledge that makes you more competitive, I don't really feel like that actually has any traction. It just gets anybody any work anymore. And I feel like the primary reason why people gatekeep this industry is because it was hard for them to get going. And so it should be hard for other people to get going too. And there's some ego associated with that. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's really intentional. I think 99% of it is non-intentional, but I think just surfacing it and talking about it and attacking it and saying like, can we stop doing this? Because there's a lot of people that could actually have a really good career here. It's not like we have too many engineers and everybody is struggling to find work. It's actually like, we don't have enough people that are doing this job. So why are we making it hard for people to do this job when it's actually not as complicated as we're making it out to be? Mm. That's all I want to say about that. So to give some context, I got started by starting my own, like I taught myself by building my own application and starting a company. And then luckily getting a little bit of traction, being able to hire some people and actually getting to be a CTO of a very, very, very small company, like 5 people. And that went well. And it positioned me so that I could actually then move to Toronto. And I did work for, I basically worked as a one person services company for a company. And then I went into a product company and then I went back to a services company. I guess what you're saying, I'm just echoing it. It was that there's not, the best first job you can get is the one you can get, just within reason. You know?
Yeah. I mean, you don't want to like, I mean, I would even say
web pages for whatever. I don't know.
I don't know. Like, I think if you can get any experience, it's good, but yeah, I get what you mean. Like, you don't want to go into like something that you're going to hate.
Yeah. But for the most part, I think it's fine. And I would say that, and I would also say like it's important to understand there's lots of other options out there. So if and when you do get to the, and it's totally okay within a fixed period of time to be like, okay, I'm kind of done with this job. I want to go do something else now. Mm-hmm. Because you've, like, it's tech. So it's very, very common to switch over your jobs often. Obviously, maybe like, you know, get the next job before you go to the next one. But that's pretty much all I had to say, I guess. So one thing I would just want to double back down to, sure, is the idea that if you are going to freelance, I think that freelancing I'm a big fan of it. If you're the kind of person that has like a strong entrepreneurial sense, if you find that you don't like working for other people, I personally prefer freelancing because I like to be in charge of myself. And that's nothing, there's no wrong or right. Some people like to have a boss. Some people don't like to have a boss. So it's just a question of like what motivates you. Mm-hmm. Now, that being said, if you're going to freelance, you basically are saying to yourself, I am going to start my own business. And you cannot treat yourself like just another employee. You've got to, like Matt said, you've got to start setting up a legal business entity. You got to talk to maybe an accountant or at least get out there. You know, it might even be useful if we just source some information on that. But you've actually got to do some groundwork and set up a business. And then you have to pay yourself. And you also have to save money because all those things that other companies would give you for free, you now have to pay for. And so, yeah, I mean, like, if you can find that kind of work, great. There's a lot of companies out there that kind of help bridge the gap between the agency and freelance world. And we can talk more about that later and put some resources up about that, I guess. But I think it's a really, like, it's something I really enjoy. It's just that you do need to plan for being, having downtime and also having business expenses. And as long as you do that, then it could be a lot of fun. The downside of the freelancing world is that any mentorship or any networking or any professional development, again, that's going to have to come out of your own personal cost. So you're charging your company, whatever. If you're not setting aside some hours per week for your own personal development or reaching out and learning more, they're not paying you to self-improve like a services or a product company will. So that's just another thing you've got to be ready. I personally prefer that. Because then I get to go learn and work with people and do stuff like this. Yeah. And I get to choose the people that I hang out with instead of being forced to do hackathons.
Build products over the course. Because I had a few experiences with freelancing before. And so like, I think I've definitely gone through, I think freelancing, you should get a significant base. Either you should do it as your first thing to get started. If you can find a client, just go for it. That's one of the things that I did early on and it was great. You know, I built a few websites and learned some stuff and then I got my first like full-time job as a developer. But like what I think is like, so like there's that feast and famine cycle. And if you're really junior or if you're like getting started, it can be, if you can deal with it, that's fine. But if you're still living
in your parents' basement and you're and you haven't got used to a regular dev paycheck, then you might be able to deal with it too.
Yeah. I mean, and like, even then, like, let's say you're in school is when I was doing it. I was freelancing through university.
And it's great.
And it was great. But you know, I was living off of, you know, six, I would like some nights, some months I would have rent, like my $550 rent plus an extra $200.
Oh my God. Oh my God, $550
for rent and then an extra $1,000. You know, it varies and it's not going to be as consistent early on, but if you can find a provider like A-Team, which I think the key to getting into these types of scenarios and having this network is to like be in the industry, have something behind you, be able to talk about it. So I think you got to get your start somehow, get it however you can. But for me, I think like you were saying, the entrepreneurial side. Yeah, I think there's trade-offs that you get either way, but I think it's a great career in terms of like just the opportunity that you have. And like, we could do a follow-up episode, I think, on like how we would.
One thing I wanted to add, just one quick thing is that I could already hear the question is how much more should a freelancer get paid than a full-time employee? I would literally say double. If the gross isn't 2 times greater, then it's not economically worth it. because of the other things you will have to account for.
Yeah. Like my general rule is like, if you're going to work for 3 month or 6 month contracts and just assume that most contracts end up being like 3 to 6 months, like
yeah.
I would say 3 months is like just in case, yeah. assume. That means every 3 months you're taking 2 to 3 weeks to find new work.
Yeah, and at least.
And you can do that while you've got the full-time role, but no matter what, still have that risk. And also you have to buy your own computer, which, you know, yeah. it's not that expensive, but it's expensive.
Yeah.
Especially when you want a good dev machine and you're like a stickler for a Mac. That's my problem.
I'm actually going to switch back to PC.
Probably, I can't even understand it, man. I had to use PC for my first 3 days using like AWS workspaces. And I was just like, I can't press these two buttons and have all the windows move in the way I want. I'm like, I don't know. Mac is just so perfect. Everything just works so well, you know?
I know. We'll see. I might just fucking buy a new.
But you know what? PC is probably fucking amazing. I you can get like a way, way better machine for like.
Anyway. All right. Okay. We should probably wrap up, right?